Welcome back. I'm Ian Masterson. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Galvin, who's Professor of History at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his forthcoming book, From Modernization to Globalization, the United States, the Middle East, and the World Economy in the 20th Century. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galvin.
Thank you for having me.
And clearly there have been some serious, first of all, there's a growing isolation and global isolation of the Assad regime, but those that still have connections, like the neighbors next door to the north, Turkey, who seem to have played the most constructive role so far, while the United States has seemed to be keeping a distance for reasons which we could get into, which somewhat mystify me. But the long and the short of it is the Syrian, the Turkish foreign minister apparently gave Assad a dressing down, and the three Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, pulled their ambassadors, and the Saudis were quite outspoken in talking about the brutality of this regime. Are there some cracks developing here, do you think?
First of all, I really have to be very cynical about when the Saudis start talking about the brutality of a regime or their lust for democracy. The outside support, I mean, the ramping up of the violence has been really extraordinary in the last 2 or 3 weeks. I mean, right now we're in the midst of Ramadan, and right now there is a campaign going on to try to put down the demonstrations, the protests that are taking place. Particularly, Hama appears to be over. Deir ez-Zor is ongoing. Deir ez-Zor is a provincial town way to the east of Syria. So the level of violence has just gotten to be absolutely extraordinary in the most recent period. And this is very likely the reason why that the Turks, the Saudis, and various other people as well have not been able to sit on their hands.
So the other indicator, perhaps, of some splits within the Assad regime was the recent firing of the defense minister, who is an Alawite, and this is the Alawite regime. That's the Assads and their security people all come from that minority tribe of about, 15% of the population. They hold most of the power and enforce they're the enforcers of the regime. He quit, and he was replaced by a Christian general. Some speculation out there suggests that maybe some of the Alawites are trying to break with the regime, because what the regime, I think, is telling the minorities, whether they be Alawites and Christians, they're saying, if you don't stick with us and we go under, the Sunni majority will slaughter us all. So your fate is tied to ours. I mean, that's the subtext of the Assad regime's message, isn't it?
Yes, and it has been for quite a while. The Assad regime has fundamentally said, look, you know, it's us or one of two things, the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood on the one hand or sectarian violence on the other hand. That being said, I would not read an extraordinary amount into this sacking in terms of either splits within the community or what have you, for a couple of reasons. Number one, from the very beginning, Alawites have come out against the repression that the Assad regime has done. I mean, Assad rules not only as a minority, but also in terms of tribal and clan loyalties as well. And not every member of the Alawite community is a member of Assad's clan or is a member of Assad's community, which he's relied on quite a bit. The other thing is that's important is that sectarian identity is not necessarily coextensive with political identity. They overlap for sure. But on the other hand, it's sectarian identity is certainly not destiny. So we have a splitting that has taken place within the community very likely, very possibly. But on the other hand, we also have a situation in which the Assad regime is still extremely has a lot of resources upon which to draw.
So the Assad regime's main resource in terms of repression seems to be the younger brother Maher, right? He first of all has the best equipped and the most loyal regime, both in the military, the brigade that he controls, and also the Republican Guards. But he also has this group called the Ghosts. They're often referred to as ninjas. Can you describe their activities?
Right. This is the so-called Ashba, which literally translates from the Arabic as ghosts. They're the hired thugs. We've seen them in every one of these protests that have taken place throughout the Middle East. For example, in Egypt, you had what they call the Baltagia, hatchet men, literally, who work with security forces. It's these people who are being used as the cutting edge of the state violence against the population. But they're not the only ones as well. For example, probably your listeners remember the case of Hamza al-Khatib, the young boy who was returned, his body was returned, he was picked up in a demonstration, kept for a couple of days, his body was returned to his parents in a mutilated state. That was Air Force intelligence. Hafez al-Assad, Bashar al-Assad's father, was in Air Force, came out of the Air Force, and the Air Force intelligence has this particular reputation for violence as well. So there are these aspects of the regime that are under the control, not only direct control of the Assad family, but under the control, for example, of, like the Ashba, people from his from the area from which he came, which is around the Latakia region of Syria.
So, again, I'm speaking with James Galvin, a professor of history at UCLA, a specialist on Syria. We're talking about possible cracks in the Syrian regime that's becoming more and more isolated, with condemnation from some of its Arab neighbors and previous supporters, like the Saudis and the Gulf states and Kuwait. But on the other hand, the Iranians are apparently not. I understand they've given up to $6 billion in credit to prop up this regime, and also they've sent in the Bashij militia and Revolutionary Guard Corps to crack heads, since they've had some practice putting down the Green Revolution in Iran. So what's this? Where do we stand on sanctions? Because obviously military intervention has never been on the table. You could excuse the Obama administration for having its hands full and not wanting to get anywhere near any more intervention. But on the other hand, I think cynically what's happening here is that because of the press blackout, the American people are not seeing the true nature of the brutality of this regime. And that's fine with the administration. They just don't want to bother with this one. But at some point or other, the rest of the world's outrage is growing. And I don't understand why, if we have sanctions against the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is the regime that runs Iran that we hate so much, and they're trying to prop up Assad, you'd think that the U.S. Would think, well, maybe we should be happy to see the end of Assad.
Well, we do have sanctions against the regime. We have sanctions against Bashar and against his brother Maher and a whole bunch of other people as well. And we also have sanctions, by the way, against the Iranian groupings within Syria that are theoretically, again, we don't really know for sure, that are more than theoretically very likely to be perpetrating either the violence or to be at least helping the Syrian state in maintaining control. But you have to understand that American policy is long-term in terms of Syria. And we have not come out against Bashar al-Assad for a number of reasons. It's a very, very rough neighborhood that he's in. Syria's borders are next to Turkey's, are next to Iraq's, are next to Israel, et cetera, et cetera. The United States does not want to see a fragmentation of this regime. It does not want to see the sectarian violence that it thinks will happen if Bashar al-Assad falls. It doesn't want to see that spill over into, for example, Lebanon. It doesn't want to see ethnic violence between Arabs and Kurds, for example, spilling over into either Iraq or into Turkey. And frankly, Bashar al-Assad has been very, very good about keeping that border quiet between Israel and Syria. There is no peace treaty, of course, between the two. But then again, there hasn't been active hostilities. And if your listeners remember back a couple of months when Palestinians, unarmed Palestinians, went to the border and several were killed in a demonstration, that was probably a show by the Syrian government of what could possibly happen should this regime fall.
So that was their way to tell the Israelis that we can make life miserable for you. And the Israelis have also taken the American line, which is a hands-off approach, it would seem.
Right.
But that seems to be...
There was this wonderful incident of, or story of Michael Oren, who is the Israeli ambassador to the United States, having to deny that he was going around to various embassies in the United States, saying that Israel wants the regime to stay in power. He had to deny that. So, again, it's one of those things. Syria so far has been very, ironically, has been very, very good for Israel, ironically in the sense that it is the head of the resistance camp, theoretically, in the Arab world. But on the other hand, has kept that border very, very quiet for the Israelis.
But that's, James Galvin, the Turks have clearly have gone beyond our kind of, realpolitik calculus that the devil we know is better than the devil we don't know. It seems like they're thinking of a post-Assad regime. And I guess, one could be sympathetic to some of the minorities in Syria, seeing what happened next door in Iraq. But then, you can blame George W. Bush for that, surely. I mean, nobody wants to break up Syria. They just want to free it from this murderous government.
Right, but again, this is the dictator spin. I mean, we've heard this with Hosni Mubarak. We've heard this with Ali Abdullah Saleh. Everybody says the same thing. After me, the deluge. After me, what's going to happen is either an Islamist takeover or this is going to be a bust-up. Now, American policy is such that we certainly do not want either one to take place. And the United States is actually following the same sort of policies that it's followed pretty much everywhere else. I mean, for example, if you look at Bahrain, for example, in which a minority government like Syria, a minority government rules over a majority. In this case, in the case of Bahrain, it's a minority Sunni government ruling over a majority Shi'i government, which means that, of course, the United States fears Iranian influence. So therefore, when Saudi Arabia moved into Bahrain and committed all sorts of atrocities in Bahrain, the United States didn't let out a murmur.
So what then is the likely scenario here, do you think, James Galvin? Because I don't think in spite of our realpolitik reluctance to look beyond this regime, and I can't imagine why we think that it's worth holding on to this regime. The rest of the world seems to be moving inexorably. More sanctions. They're starting to cut off their oil supply. It would seem that once you break the patronage lock that the Assad clan have over the bazaars and the middle class in Damascus. And if the Christians, for example, have some kind of assurances that they're not going to end up like the Iraqi Christians, I would think that you could have a peaceful transition.
I think we're way beyond the idea of a peaceful transition at this point. The other thing, though, is
so what's going to happen then if he falls? Just give us the grim scenario.
Well, I mean, there are several things. One thing is in the assumption that, for example, where the Christians will come down. This regime has lasted for 40 years, Hafez al-Assad and Bashar al-Assad, simply because it did an extraordinarily good job, not only of concentrating immediate power into its own hands, but also allowing a number of other groupings, not just Alawites, to expand their economic base and patronage and so on and so forth. They brought in, for example, Christian merchant families, mostly from Damascus, but also from Aleppo, who don't want to see the regime go. So you have ties between Alawites and Christians, and it's not just the minority thing. They both benefit from those ties. As far as what outsiders can do or will do, they've pretty much reached the limits of what they can and will do. I mean, you can have harsh words for Bashar al-Assad, you could have sanctions on Bashar al-Assad, but you have to remember, number one, that the Iranians certainly like this regime, want to maintain this regime, and will do whatever is necessary in order to keep this regime in power, and that the rest of the world is extraordinarily ambivalent. So what I think everybody is hoping for is that if it has to be done dirty, in other words, if the regime has to stay in power by committing those atrocious acts of violence that it has been committing for the last particularly month, you know, hopefully it'll be over quickly and they'll be able to put down this rebellion. That's what I think everybody is hoping for.
Well, that is a very disturbing and uncomfortable truth, if that is indeed the true behind-the-scenes attitude that these governments have, that are all expressing outrage.
Unfortunately, I think that we don't know what's going on in the councils of government. As I said before, the Americans have pretty much played out a very specific set of scenarios in terms of how it wants to deal with the various Arab uprisings that have taken place since Tunisia. The Saudis are certainly not somebody that you should bank on for supporting democratic change anywhere in the Middle East or in the Arab world in particular. And the idea that there's anything further that can be done in terms of American outrage or European outrage or even the neighbors themselves, it's probably not going to do a whole hell of a lot. This regime has seized its back against the wall, and it has not hesitated in the past from using the most extraordinary means of violence in order to protect itself.
Well, I guess there's a part of me that just finds that hard to accept, James Galvin, even though this is a perfectly reasonable and rational argument. I can't see it how at the end of the day such a hideous clan could preside over a seething population. It's the same situation in Iran. At the end of the day, I still think the Revolutionary Guard Corps regime will crumble because, as the opposition says, we are the burning embers beneath the ashes. And if you, with such sheer brutality, you put down the aspirations of these people, the majority of the people in a country, that doesn't mean the aspirations go away.
No, you're absolutely right. And in this season in particular of the Arab uprisings, all bets are off. But this regime has maintained itself in power for a very long period of time, and Arab autocracies in general have maintained themselves in power for a very long period of time. What we're seeing now is a level of brutality that we don't normally experience. But if you look at Gaddafi's Libya, for example, or the Saudi state, or any of these other places in the Middle East, that violence is there right below the surface. Mm-hmm. And the world really has not either objected to it or done anything about it until until January, actually, of this year.
Well, I thank you for joining us, James Galvin. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with James Galvin, professor of history at UCLA. His research focuses on the Middle East, particularly Greater Syria, the area of present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. He's the author of Divided Loyalties, Nationalism, and Mass Politics in Syria at the Close of Empire, The Modern Middle East, A History, and his forthcoming book, From Modernization to Globalization, The United States, the Middle East, and the World Economy in the 20th Century. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back, joined by the New Republic's John Judas.
زخ رصاص على الناس العزل يا حيف واطفال بعمر الورد اعتقلن كيف زخ رصاص